From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Today, we look at our lust for life lists.
The 50 Greatest Things That Just Popped Into My Head by Jack Pendarvis. That's me. 50, ice cream. 49, blue. Don't try to get creative with your favorite color. We all know it's blue. 48, sneeze. It feels great to sneeze. What a relief. 47. Jesus. Love him or hate him, you've got to hand it to the Son of God. Over 2,000 years old and still going strong. It's no wonder his name is also an exclamation. Jesus! 46. Oxygen. What a fantastic element. And not just because it's easy to breathe. There is so much to recommend oxygen. According to scientists, nothing beats oxygen. 45. Bill. A friend of mine. He's nice. I'm sorry we haven't kept in touch as well as we might have, Bill. Say hello to Lisa. 44. Lisa. I secretly think you are hot. Don't tell Bill. 43. Windows. You can see what's outside yet feel safe and protected. It's all thanks to windows. Who thought up windows? We may never know. But that man or lady had it going on. 42. Lists of 50 things in magazines. Thought-provoking, not a waste of time at all.
Jack Pendarvis reading an excerpt from The 50 Greatest Things That Just Popped Into My Head, which appears in The Believer magazine. We'll count down more of Jack's 50 Greatest Things later this hour as we look at life lists. But first, music critic Tom Moon. He's the author of 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die, a listener's life list. The book features Moon selections from a wide variety of genres, including rock, gospel, jazz, opera, and hip-hop. Tom Moon talked to Steve Paulson about how the words "before you die" in the title of his book really up the ante.
That's not to say that all of them are sort of rubber-stamped by the critics and or the scholars and are going to be in the big time capsule when we look back on, you know, in 50 years. But the before you die part for me really clarified this idea that we do need to pick wisely and choose wisely what we spend our time listening to. And I think a lot of people, particularly young people, are really not oriented that way. And we don't know how much time we have left. And if we operate on the assumption that we'll get around to the great stuff and or the stuff that might be uplifting and challenging as a listening experience someday, we may never get to it. And we may find ourselves in a situation where our favorites, that sort of small playlist that is the hot one, becomes like our main listening activity. And to me, that's just the thing that's always happened to me since I was a kid was hearing something that I didn't know, encountering it completely blind, coming from left field, out of a store, on the radio, whatever, and having the conversion experience or the eureka moment that says, wow, this is amazing. I need this in my life.
So that's partly what you want to do, is to both cite some fairly obscure musicians, but also some of the popular ones that also people should know.
Yeah, because, you know, it's all good. It's not like we're saying here, you know, this is the cod liver oil of music, and you must know this to be an educated citizen. It's more like there's great music to be had that's just pure guilty pleasure giddiness and incredibly deep symphonic music that speaks of world tragedy and everything in between. But to get back to that life list idea, the sense that when there's so much coming at you, you're not always able to discern and pick out the things that do have lasting value. And it was an enormously challenging exercise to think about how I would equip a new listener, what needs to be in that person's back pocket. But as challenging as it was also incredibly restorative and life-affirming to say, you know what, in the great river of stuff that's passing us by every day, there are things that deserve to be in the time capsule, and there are things that people want to maybe think about in more depth and engage more fully than they do, you know, whatever the new release is.
Let's talk about some of the recordings on your list.
Sure.
Ray Charles, the best of Ray Charles, the Atlantic years. Why is this so important?
Well, Ray Charles, one of the great singers of all time, certainly a visionary in terms of building what we call soul music. And in developing the book, when we started, we said we would not have greatest hits anthologies. We would avoid that stuff because it's somewhat a cheat to say, all right, you know, here's X, Y, and Z, greatest hits from all these artists. That would be an easy book to assemble in a way. But some artists are very tricky and their catalogs present particular challenges. And Ray Charles is one of them, where those early records he made, the early 45 singles that he made for Atlantic, are so important to everything that comes after, whether it's Little Richard, James Brown, Sly Stone, whoever. Everybody checked those records out, Sam Cooke. And if you only have What I'd Say or one or two of them, what you miss is the sense of how many different worlds he hit in the course of one single after another and how many different ways he spun, you know, what his basic concept of music was. So that's one part of Ray Charles. And if you get, you know, if you're only going to get one record, that should be it, or some anthology like that. But then there's the other side of Ray Charles, which was as a more experimental figure and someone who was interested in extending what he did as a singer into different realms, and his work in country and western, which is the other entry in the book, which is called Modern Sounds in Country and Western, Volume 1 and 2, is almost more mind-blowing than the soul records, because here he is, an African-American guy who knows how to sing, understands the blues and a lot of music that came before him, and yet he's singing, you know, cheating heart songs that are not necessarily associated with him, and personalizing them and making them come alive in a way that just blows you away.
Hmm. So if you were to pick out one Ray Charles song that illustrates either one or the other of these kinds of ideas, what would it be?
Oh, boy. I guess I Got a Woman.
Well, I got a woman way over town that's good to me. Oh, yeah. Say, I got a woman way over town, good to me. Oh, yeah. She give me money when I'm in need. Yeah, she's a kind of friend indeed. I got a woman way over town.
You can't go wrong with Ray Charles, though. It's one of those things where you pick out one song and then you can think of 10 others that would work just as well.
You mentioned Prince and how he spans all kinds of musical genres. What was your selection from Prince?
Well, I picked two. One is the soundtrack to Purple Rain, which was his commercial breakthrough. And then a few years later, he has this great double record called Sign of the Times. And both of them are incredibly electric records. I think you could make a case for Prince. First of all, he's probably the most gifted live performer we have. But in addition to that, you can make a case for him as being possibly the greatest assimilator in pop music history, or at least one of them. When you hear him, when you hear something like It's Gonna Be a Beautiful Night from the Sign of the Times record, you're hearing horn writing that comes out of the Duke Ellington tradition. You're hearing a rhythm bed that has a lot to do with James Brown, and some vocal stuff that reaches to Sarah Vaughan and goes well beyond his sort of wheelhouse as a singer. And this happens again and again and again through his catalog, almost on every record. And this is another case where he's really tying things together and bringing a lot of the music of the past into what he does in the moment. And I think that's incredibly important. It's something that artists today need to see and learn from and experience, because nothing exists in a vacuum.
A very different kind of singer is the Canadian singer-songwriter Sarah McLachlan. You have her 1997 album, Surfacing. What's so special about this album?
A couple things. First of all, it's gorgeously produced. It's one of those records that you put it on and it just surrounds you. It has a very sumptuous sound to it. It has that aura of not overwhelming you, but actually sort of seeping into your consciousness, which records in the 90s, in the age of the CD, you find that less and less. So first, it's like a tone texture issue. And then on top of that, she's written beautiful pop songs that some of them have the lilting piano that harks back to the Beatles' Let It Be or whatever. And some of them are much, much more even spacier than that. And these melodies are true melodies. You can sit there and hear one of these songs from that record, walk away, be traveling down the street or driving in your car, no music on, and you can conjure the melody as an entire arc. And that's also something that I think is very rare in pop music now. A lot of these melodies are like itty-bitty two-measure phrases that repeat forever and ever. And Sarah McLachlan on this record, in a case of a song like Angel, it's like you can sing this whole long, extended, beautiful melody, and it can stay with you forever. And I think that's really a hallmark of great pop music, and it's something that we don't see as much anymore.
So tired of the straight line, and everywhere you turn, there's vultures and thieves at your back. Storm keeps on twisting. You keep on building lies that you make up for all that you lack. It don't make no difference. Escape one last time. It's easier to believe in this sweet man.
Sarah McLachlan with Angel from her 1997 album, Surfacing. Tom Moon is the author of 1,000 Recordings You Must Hear Before You Die, A Listener's Life List. He spoke with Steve Paulson. And this is Sarah McLachlan with Last Dance, an instrumental from her Surfacing album. What are your all-time favorite recordings, and why? You can let us know by sending us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, 13 books that changed America. And we're off to the cinema as we continue our look at life lists. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Jay Parini is a poet, novelist, and teacher. He's also the author of Promised Land, 13 books that changed America.
This is not a list of great books. Only probably two or three of these books would be considered great books with big capital letters. I'd say Huckleberry Finn, Walden. Let me think. That's about it. two great books on this list of 13 books. The other books are profound, influential books, books that really changed the way Americans saw themselves. And what I also say in my intro is these are not just books that stand alone. No books that are important stand alone. Each of these is a climate of opinion, and maybe two dozen, three dozen books swirl around it. There are all the books that led up to it, and then all the books that come from it. For example, with Walden by Henry David Thoreau. This didn't come from nowhere. He'd been reading the German Romantics. He'd been reading the essays of Emerson. He'd been reading a lot of nature writers, Gilbert White in England. And so he was coming from somewhere, and a lot of different important influences suddenly converged in Henry David Thoreau while he sat in his cabin at Walden Pond. And then you think of the endless books that flowed out of Henry David Thoreau. The whole tradition of American nature writing kind of expands from him. Books like Pilgrim at Tinker Creek by Annie Dillard. Yeah. I mean, there's a vast range of books that come out of Thoreau. So like I said, each of these books is kind of a nodal point, but there are the books that come before it and the books that then hugely follow in its wake.
What ways did Walden change America then that Emerson didn't? Did Emerson change Thoreau so that Thoreau could write Walden and change America?
Well, Emerson was always kind of rhetorical and in some ways theoretical. His sentences are absolutely perfect, but rarely does it add up in the kind of way that Walden adds up. Walden is a wonderful narrative. And over the generations, now Walden, remember, was not a bestseller at its time. I don't think he sold 5,000 copies. But it's one of those books that gradually gathered weight as the decades rolled on. And by the 20th century, this was a book where, can you think of how many readers have read this book and gone for a walk in the woods, have read this book and suddenly saw connections between spirit and nature that simply they hadn't seen before. I first read Walden when I was about 20 years old, and I can remember really going on a backpacking trip shortly thereafter and sitting under a tree and underlining passages. This is a book that I've gone back to every year in my entire adult life, and I take a walk myself in the woods every afternoon. I go for an hour and a half in the woods near my house in Vermont. And the spirit of Henry David Thoreau lives with me. Passages from that book keep circulating in my memory. He informs the way I see things. He's such a visual writer. You never look at a pond the same after seeing Henry David Thoreau. You see it as a metaphor of mind. And it's like this with all of these books. Once they're read, they change the way we live our lives.
That's Walden's legacy in one sense. There's another, though, isn't there? Another of the books that is on your list of 13 is Uncle Tom's Cabin, Harriet Beecher Stowe's book. You don't think of Thoreau as caring much about race, but in fact, he cared very much. He was a strong abolitionist. It leads almost directly to Stowe.
Oh, you know, those two books work wonderfully in apposition next to each other. Thoreau was, of course, a strong abolitionist. And, you know, I think one of the reasons he refused to pay his poll tax was because of slavery. He was an anti-imperialist. He was a terribly interesting guy. I mean, of course, he wrote Civil Disobedience, the work that so much inspired Mahatma Gandhi in India and South Africa and influenced Martin Luther King so profoundly. Now, Harriet Beecher Stowe is an interesting story. Her book is not read much these days, but it was, after the Bible, the best-selling book of the 19th century in America, possibly in the whole world. I don't know about that, but certainly in America it was. They had to keep 8 printing presses going 24 hours a day for months and years on end, trying to keep up with the demand for this book. When Abraham Lincoln invited Harriet Beecher Stowe to the White House, and I think it was in the midst of the Civil War, I'm thinking it was 1863 he invited her, he greeted her at the door of the White House, took her hand in his big hand, looked down and said, "Aha, you're the little lady that started this great war." And there is the sense in which Uncle Tom's Cabin galvanized abolitionist opinion in the North and somehow made it intellectually and spiritually possible to go to war against your neighbors and your brothers.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because this is one of only, I think, three novels on your list, and you're giving it a lot of weight. A novel shouldn't be able to start a war. A novel shouldn't be the diatribe that gets people thinking. And yet...
Harry Beecher Stowe, let me tell you the truth. Of all the 13 books on my list, this is the only one I had never read before. I knew it was important. I wondered what it was like. I had read how much influence it had on America's thinking about abolition and about slavery and how it had affected the whole nation and the world. And I sat down to read it one morning and thought, well, I don't know how much time I'll spend on this. Well, I read till midnight. I read the whole book in one single day. She's one of the great storytellers of all time. I mean, this is Stephen King on steroids. I mean, it's good. And also, it's actually one hell of a story. You know, I love the tale. It's thrilling to read, and it's extremely well written.
You make a case for novels here, too, because she's telling a story that is not factually correct, maybe, but that is spiritually correct. It brings to life a time and a place and attitudes that a dry recitation of the facts wouldn't accomplish.
That's right. Sometimes novels are truer than history. I was chatting with my English friend Peter Ackroyd the other day, and he writes biographies and novels. And I said, Peter, what's the difference between your biographies and your novels? And he said, well, in my biographies, I feel free to invent things, but in novels, I have to tell the truth. There's something wonderfully Oscar Wildean about that fact. But novels sometimes can be truer than facts.
Yeah. Another of the novels that you've included in here is Huckleberry Finn, and I think a lot of people would agree that that is a novel, both good and bad in some ways, that has affected thousands of Americans in the years since.
Well, you know, it's the most quintessentially American novel for various reasons. One reason is that Mark Twain embodied the American language, the kind of vernacular, the way people really spoke, in a way that had never been done before in fiction. And I still think it's the authentic American voice, Mark Twain. And he got it just right in Huckleberry Finn. Sometimes it's so poetic, you know, when they're gliding along the river, the description of the islands and the forests along the side are so beautiful, the sunset on the water. It's also a great story. It's a wonderful story about race. I mean, the relationship between Huck and so-called Nigger Jim is very complex. And as you know, Huck sides with Jim and decides in favor of setting him free, even though he's breaking the law in his own view. It's also a novel about lighting out for the territory. I mean, this is a very crucial American mental motion, the idea that we must set out for the West, go out into the wilderness. One of the aspects of the American character that so comes through in all these books is this adventurousness, this willingness to go into the wilderness, to take your chances, to take a risk. Goes right back to the Pilgrims landing in Plymouth Rock.
You know, listening to you, I realize that there is a certain quality about lists that obviously appeals to you. Lists of people, lists of books, lists of ideas that are a continuum throughout the history of America.
Yeah, well, that's because I'm an insomniac. I lie in bed at night thinking of these things, but I do see a continuum. I see so many different strands in American life. I see our rational strand, the self-inventiveness that goes from Ben Franklin through Dale Carnegie right up to the present. And I see a deep spiritual strand, starting with the Plymouth plantation and our founding pilgrims. You know, there was this obsessive religious streak in American culture. I see our love of nature, which goes, you know, from the journals of Lewis and Clark through Walden, right up to On the Road with Jack Kerouac, this, you know, love of the countryside, of nature.
You know, there are a lot of lists out there. There are a lot of life list books, you know, 1001 paintings you've got to see before you die. Do you have any idea why, you must have some idea, why we like these lists so much?
Well, I've always been a list lover, and I do know that an editor at a magazine once said to me, if we want to sell a copy of an issue of our magazine, we put on the cover the 12 or 13 or 7 great something or others. And people love these kinds of lists because experience is so disparate and life is so confusing and chaotic that whenever we try to make sense of things, we start making lists. I mean, lists are the way we organize our daily lives, and lists of ideas, of people. I'm always making lists of one kind or another. And this is how I organize my thoughts and organize my experience.
Jay Perini is the author of Promised Land, 13 books that changed America. Let's check in again with Jack Pendarvis, reading from his essay, The 50 Greatest Things That Just Popped Into My Head.
27. Internet. 26. Lemon Pledge. 25. Snowflakes. No two are alike. 24. Magna Carta. Lots of good stuff in there. You go, Magna Carta. 23. Pumice Stone Jello. That one is a tie. 18. Words. Be it a book or a billboard. There wouldn't be much to it without words. Words tell us what we are thinking. Hats off to words.
Jack Pendarvis continuing his countdown of the 50 greatest things that just popped into his head. This list appears in The Believer magazine. We'll hear more from Jack at the end of the show. David Thompson's a film critic. He's written many books about the movies, including the new Biographical Dictionary of Film. Thompson's new book is called Have You Seen A Personal Introduction to 1,000 Films? As he told Steve Paulson, this book is not a list of the 1,000 greatest films.
I don't believe in saying any list is the greatest. I think a list is a personal thing. It's a matter of taste. The films, even if I were to make a list of 1,000 films that I hand on heart believe are the greatest films ever made, it would still look as personal and as idiosyncratic as this list does. I think the movies are a place where we're all critics, we're all experts. I often say when I'm talking about this thing that if I come forward and introduce myself to you, or I'm introduced to you as a brain surgeon, anything I say you're going to accept with enormous reverence. And if I say, you know, you've got a twitch in your lower eyelid, I think you should have a CAT scan, you're going to go and have a CAT scan because I'm a brain surgeon. If I'm a film critic and I say, for instance, I thought Slumdog Millionaire was awful and you liked it, you're going to be indignant and you're going to say, I liked it. And you're going to feel that you have every right to come back at me and say, well, that's just your opinion. And you're dead right, because that's all it is, and that's all that critics offer. Sometimes some critics have an eloquence and a depth of knowledge that may persuade you. And those are, I think, the really good critics. And also they write so well, perhaps, that they get you to see a film that you might not have thought of seeing otherwise. But it's not a question of being right and being wrong.
Well, it does raise the question, though, of how you happen to choose these 1,000 films. What were your criteria?
Well, I chose the films I wanted to write about. And, you know, for me, I do the writing. It's quite hard work. And I don't really want to write about too many films that bore me. So I started writing about films I like, not necessarily films I like more than any other, but films that I would happily and cheerfully recommend to other people. And I started just doing that, and I began to accumulate. And then I thought, well, this book has a danger of being one rave after another. And as a book that people are going to read, I don't want that. I want it to have more variety. So I thought, well, you know, there are films that many, many people consider wonderful and important and absolutely essential and would have to be in your 1,000, like The Sound of Music, which would not be in my 1,000.
You don't really like The Sound of Music, do you?
I don't really like it, but so what, you know. But I knew that many people would expect The Sound of Music in the book, so I put it in the book, and I say that I don't like it very much. And again, I think people can take that or leave it. They can deal with it as they like. But what it means is that this is a book with a lot of films I do like. There are probably three quarters of the films in this book are films I like a lot. Certainly my favorite 50 are all there, but there's also something like a couple of hundred that I think are important historically without necessarily ever having won my favor.
Well, I have to ask you about the very first film that you write about, and you've arranged this alphabetically, so we start with the A's, and it's the 1948 film Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
It tells you a lot about the way I approach the book, I think. When I was well on in the work, I had a list already, a working list of how many films, and I showed it to a few people, friends, film buffs, film authorities, because I was always afraid that I was going to leave out something very, very obvious, because I hadn't gone about this list totally systematically. And I showed it to a friend, Michael Barker, who works for Sony Classics and is one of the great distributors of independent films in this country. And he looked at the list, and the first film on the list was Abe Lincoln in Illinois. And he said, David, I open this big book, and the first page I see Abe Lincoln in Illinois. And he said, are you crazy about Abe Lincoln in Illinois? And I said, well, Michael, no, I'm not really crazy about it. It's a worthy film. It's okay. I think anyone could see it with a little value. But, you know, it just happens that alphabetically my list presents that as number one. And he said, David, you're not helping yourself. You're not helping your book. You need on that first page something that will surprise people and something that will go to the heart of the book and your whole passion for movies. Something, it might be great, it might be crazy. It's sort of one of the two, but it's something extreme. And I knew he was right. It was dead right. And so we got out an almanac that has got pretty well every film in it, Leonard Maltin's invaluable guide, because we needed something that would fit alphabetically. What did we find but Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein? And with one voice, we said, that is it, because that is not perhaps a great film, but it is so movie-like, if you know what I mean. That's what the movies do. They do stupid things like Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Count Dracula sleeps in this coffin, but rises every night at sunset. Chick is right. This is awful silly stuff.
The nation's top comics, Abbott and Costello. Petrified, but hilariously. Plus the dangerous and terrifying Wolfman, played by Lon Chaney. Plus that fiend out of a nightmare, the vampire Batman, Count Dracula, played by Bela Lugosi. Plus the most dreaded creature of them all, the Frankenstein monster, played by Glenn Strange. In the spookiest laugh fest on record.
And I wrote what I hope is a funny piece about that. And I think it gives people immediately, if they go to the first page, it gives them the sense of the fun that there is in this book.
And it is a fun entry. I mean, the whole notion of Abbott and Costello clashing with these monsters. It's sort of a ridiculous premise that, is kind of enjoyable.
And an awful lot of movies have totally ridiculous premises. Slumdog Millionaire does, if you think about it. By the way, I quite like Slumdog Millionaire, so don't go away with the feeling I'm not keen on.
Now, I'm going to put you on the spot here. You've already said that your book is not just the great movies. There are some kind of schlocky movies in there as well. What do you think is the most overrated movie in your book?
Well, that's a wonderful question. You know, in a funny way, and please don't misunderstand me, the most overrated film ever made is the most highly rated film ever made, Citizen Kane, which has now reached a point where it automatically wins every poll there is. It's won the Sight and Sound Critics Poll for God knows how many decades in a row. And there, I think, is a film that has become a white elephant. It's something that is so vast, so enormous, no one actually looks at it anymore, and no one has the emotional experience of seeing it afresh. I think it would be a very good thing for the film if it was withdrawn for a few years and then brought back. It's often very valuable for a thing not to be capable of being seen. It makes us desire it all the more. That's a principle of cinema in itself. The thing that you don't quite show in a film becomes enormously powerful.
Well, you've already talked about your reluctance to mention greatest films and to come up with lists of greatest films, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Do you have a list of maybe the top three greatest films? And I don't know where you will place Citizen Kane now that you've been dissing it.
I mean, I've made it clear that I think Citizen Kane is extraordinary and very important. But at the moment, the three I'm going to come up with are His Girl Friday, Howard Hawks's version of The Front Page, where he turns the second male part into a female part. That's Cary Grant, Rosalind Russell.
Oh, listen, Walter. You are no longer my husband and no longer my boss. And you're not going to be my boss.
What's that supposed to mean?
Just what I say.
You mean you're not coming back to work on the paper?
You are right, Mr. Burns, for the first time today.
Got a better offer, huh?
You bet I've got a better
offer.
All
right, go on, take it, work for somebody else. That's the gratitude I get.
Oh, I wish you'd
stop panning.
What
were you when you came here 5 years ago, a little college girl from a school journalism? I took a doll-faced hick.
Well, you wouldn't take me if I hadn't been doll-faced.
Oh, why should I? I thought it'd be a novelty to have a face around here a man could look at without shuddering.
Listen, Walter.
Listen, I made a great reporter out of you, Hildy, but you won't be half as good on any other paper, and you know it. We're a team, that's what we are. You need me, and I need you, and the paper needs
both American.
I'm going to name a French film of the 70s that not many people will know called Céline and Julie Go Boating, a film which is about film going itself. And for my third film, I'm going to name, just because I love the director so much, Michael Powell's The Red Shoes.
What do you want from life? To live?
To dance.
I will do the talking. You. We do the dancing.
Good. You've left us something to go out and watch and
good,
maybe
good.
Rent.
Yes.
Yeah. I came across a review of your book by Jeff Dyer, who wrote in The Observer, saying that there's always the sense when you write about movies that there is more to film than meets the eye and that you are persistently groping towards a metaphysics of cinema. Do you think that's true?
Yes. Jeff is a good friend. His review is one I'm very proud of, very happy about. Yes, I mean, for me, cinema is a lifelong pursuit that ranges from Abbott and Costello to The Passion of Joan of Arc. And yes, I think there is ultimately some mysterious answer to all our beings in there.
So we really will find ultimate truth in the movies.
There is a rosebud for us all, yes.
See, you can't get away from Citizen Kane, even if you try.
I can't.
Rosebud.
David Thompson is the author of Have You Seen? A Personal Introduction to 1,000 Films. He spoke with Steve Paulson. So what do you think are the greatest movies of all time? How about the most overrated and underrated? And what do you think of this lust for life lists? We'd love to know what you think. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll explore the life and times of Phoebe Snetsinger, who saw some 8,400 different species of birds, as we conclude our Hour on Life lists. And Jim Fleming, it's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. You may not be able to identify these birds, but Phoebe Snetsinger probably could. Snetsinger is the subject of a new book called Life List, A Woman's Quest for the World's Most Amazing Birds. Olivia Gentile is the author of Life List. About 11 years ago, Gentile fell in love with a bird watcher. She discovered that he was clinically depressed and that birding was his salvation. Olivia Gentili told Anne Strangechamps what happened next.
Long after we broke up, I decided I wanted to write about birdwatchers, or maybe a birdwatcher. So I called up some birding clubs near my home in Manhattan. By then I was living in Manhattan. And a man at the Long Island Bird Club misunderstood the reason for my call, and he thought that I wanted to join the club. And he said, yeah, we don't get a lot of young women in our club, but you should come join. Who knows, maybe you'll be the next Phoebe Snetsinger. And a couple weeks later, I was in St. Louis interviewing her widower.
So what was it about Phoebe Snetsinger that so captured your attention?
Well, all he said, all this man said, was that she had seen more bird species than anyone in history. And I thought, well, that sounds interesting, you know, that she saw more bird species than anyone in history. So I Googled her, and I saw that there was a New York Times obituary which mentioned that she had once been a housewife, you know, a very typical suburban housewife with four children, and that the real change in her life had come when she was diagnosed with melanoma and told she had less than a year to live. And she decided to spend that year traveling the world in search of birds. And she ended up outliving her prognosis by 18 years. And as I learned that first day, seeing more bird species than anyone in history. So I thought, not only was the second half of her life fascinating, but the contrast to the first half of her life really interested me.
Birding really took off for Phoebe Snetsinger after she was diagnosed with terminal cancer. She was told she had a year, less than a year to live.
Mm-hmm. She did not question that diagnosis. She did not say, I'm going to defy my doctor's expectations. She was very accepting. She had a scientific background. She had wanted to be a scientist. And she believed these scientists who told her that that was it. And meanwhile, she'd been dreaming of traveling the world to see birds for ages. But her kids were still fairly young. Her kids were still in high school and college. And she just hadn't gotten around to taking a lot of trips yet. So as soon as she got this diagnosis, she decided, you know, well, I don't feel sick yet, and there aren't any good treatments, so I'm going to go for it. I'm going to see as many birds as I can during whatever time I have left. And she went from being utterly devastated, of course, as we all would be if we were told we had only a year to live, to incredibly alive and joyful within a couple months because she managed to live in the moment in a way that I think few of us can.
She was an amazingly brave woman. I mean, just glancing through your book, you know, she went hiking around Nepal on a trip in which another birding companion died of altitude sickness. She was birding during, what, a major earthquake in Ecuador. She survived tribal warfare in New Guinea. Didn't she ever think maybe she should stop taking such risks?
Well, and then what happened shortly after she survived that tribal warfare, she went back to New Guinea. And this was in 1986, about 5 years after her cancer diagnosis. And she had never been so happy. She just was having a ball. For these 5 years, she had lived exactly the life that she'd always wanted to live. And she was traveling about 6 months a year, I would say. And she went to New Guinea, this time with just one other person. And she was birding with this one other person at some remote sewage ponds outside the capital of New Guinea, Port Moresby. And they got assaulted by five thugs who kidnapped them, stuffed them in their own rental car, and took them to an even more remote pond and gang-raped Phoebe. Then they talked about how they were going to kill Phoebe and her friend. Her friend was a man, and that's why he was not also gang raped. And Phoebe and her friend managed to escape while these guys were trying to figure out how to kill them. You might think that this episode would have made her think that she should not be doing things like this.
Well, it sounds like a shattering experience. You'd think she would come home deeply traumatized.
Well, she was extremely traumatized. But trauma works in funny ways, I suppose. And it made her just redouble her efforts to see birds around the world. It made her decide, you know, she's not going to let, as she said, these bastards win. And she started taking even more trips to even more remote places and spending, say, 9 months of the year on the road instead of six, and going up more severe mountains and staying in even less, you know, reputable hotels and campgrounds. And
so her really, birding took on a kind of driven quality then.
Her birding became darker and more compulsive after she was raped. She never really talked about the rape with anyone. She didn't want to get counseling. She just said, I don't want it to slow me down. I'm fine. I just want to keep going, and I just want to keep seeing more birds. But she changed dramatically after the rape in that, like I said, it became a little bit less joyful for her and more of a compulsion. And that's when she really started talking about seeing more bird species than anyone in history.
How did Phoebe Snetsinger die?
Well, after she reached 8,000, she claimed that she was going to slow down. Her husband very much wanted her to. He had wanted a divorce. And she
kind of hard to be married to somebody who leaves for birding trips for 9 months of the year.
Absolutely. But, you know, he loved her and he understood that she had made a lot of sacrifices earlier in the marriage and that birding really was so important to her. So he was willing to wait for her until she had seen her 8,000 species, which did make her a celebrity in the birding world and got her a lot of recognition that she might have gotten, you know, through a career otherwise if she'd lived in a different era or had a different trajectory. So he was willing to wait, but she didn't really slow down after 8,000. She did start to take more pleasure in birding again and take trips that she wanted to take for the quality of the birds rather than the quantity. So it was a happier time for her, but she didn't really slow down. And moreover, her body started to break down because by this time she was in her late 60s. So the way she died was she had actually sprained her ankle in Madagascar on this trip. This was in 1999. And because she had sprained her ankle, she was sitting across both aisles of the bus, if you can picture a kind of school bus. She had her feet up. She was sitting with her back to the bus windows. And this bus hit a concrete abutment and rolled over. Phoebe was sleeping at the time. And unfortunately, the back of her head was what took the impact. So no one else actually in this bus was seriously hurt. But because of the way Phoebe was sitting and because she was asleep, she died.
How many birds did she wind up with on her life list?
Well, you know, it depends on the taxonomy, but about 8,400 out of 10,000, which is incredible when you consider that, you know, anyone who sort of takes a bunch of trips can probably see 4,000 or 5,000 bird species. You wouldn't be able to identify them on your own the way Phoebe could. I mean, Phoebe really learned these birds like an ornithologist would. You could see these birds and be shown these birds. But in order to see birds after you get to 5,000, you really have to suffer for them. And you have to do kind of crazy things. And you have to exert yourself in a way that most of us would not. And so really those last few hundred birds that she saw probably took her about 5 years to see. And even though she was seeing thousands of birds a year, you know, back in the 80s.
You know, there's one small moment out of your whole book that really, really sticks in my mind when I think about Phoebe, and it's not even about birds. It was a family trip she was on. Her kids were grown, and they all went together to Africa. There was one night they were staying at a lodge, and outside some elephants showed up and were bathing in a river or something right there. And they were all standing around outside. It was dusk, watching the elephants. And after a while, everybody else went inside and it was bedtime. And her daughter came and said, you know, Mom, aren't you coming to bed? And Phoebe said, oh, no, it's not every night I get to see elephants. And she must have spent several more hours just sitting outside there, just watching the elephants. I keep thinking about that. And partly it makes me wonder, do you have a particular memory out of all of the other, you know, a particular image of Phoebe out of all of those that you discovered.
Yeah, you know, I love that image. Another one, there's a very well-known and well-respected birder named Robert Ridgely who led her on one of her early trips to South America. And when I interviewed him, he said that, you know, back in those days in the early 80s, Phoebe was still a novice world birder. She knew how to identify the birds at home, but she didn't really know a lot of the birds in South America. And almost every bird she saw was a life bird, a new bird. And when she saw a bird she was really excited about, according to Bob, she would jump up and down and punch the air and smile so wide that her eyes were little slits. And just that image of Phoebe, just pure joy and, you know, pure exuberance is something that really has stuck with me.
Olivia Gentile is the author of Life List, A Woman's Quest for the World's Most Amazing Birds. She spoke with Anne Strangechamps. Gentile's book will be available at the end of March, and you can find a link to Olivia Gentile's website on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for the conclusion of The 50 Greatest Things That Just Popped Into My Head by Jack Pendarvis, from his essay of the same name in The Believer magazine.
10. Quick Draw McGraw. 9. Cheese. From brie to cheddar, there is no denying the wide-ranging appeal of cheese. 8. Ouija board. They really work. 7. Blog. Do you want to know what someone is thinking? Simply read his or her blog. 6. Autumn. The classy name for fall. 5. Because it is bitter and because it is my heart. What a kick-ass line of poetry. I may be misquoting it, but you're like, wow. 4. Unicorn. 3. Vincent Price. 2. A magic top hat. 1. Pie cooling on a windowsill.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 38B, Lust for Life Lists. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strangechamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.